The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager bringing you The Heretics Hour on Monday, August 27th, 2012. This is a live show for the next 2 hours, so if you want to participate in what is discussed, send an email to carolyn@carolynyeager.com. I will try to remember to keep checking my email, but this new email provider is sometimes kind of slow in delivering some mail, so don't wait until the last minute. My last program, I found after it was over, I found three messages there, but they weren't really so much meant to be given on the air, so it wasn't too bad. But I really am unhappy with this email I have to use. But anyway, I'm not going to start in complaining about that. I want to get right to my guest tonight because it's my partner on the White Network, Tan Stoffel. Good evening, Tan.
Hi, Carolyn. Hi, everybody. Glad to be here.
Well, this is going to be fun for me. I always have fun when we're talking. We get along. We have a nice rapport, and you make it real easy for me. So I think this will be a good show. And we have a good amount of listeners already for the very beginning of the show. It usually builds up over the course of the program, and so that's a good sign. So that who knows how many we might end up with. So this is our three-month anniversary at the White Network, but we didn't really plan originally to have you on tonight for that reason, but it just coincided with the fact that we have been wanting to talk about ways to further white consciousness. You know, I've done quite a few shows about that in one way or another here on the Heretics Hour lately, and we wanted to do it together, you and I, and then you remarked that this was kind of an anniversary, and it is, because we did our very first show here on June 28th, and now this is August 27th, so you can't get much closer than that, right?
Yeah, it wasn't intentional, but that's the way it turned out.
Yeah, so here we are, and we're going to talk about our intentions for this network and what the intentions that we had and the intentions as they've 3 months later, how we look at it and how we see it and how we think we've done and what we would like to do and so on. So we're calling it our progress report. Our intentions, of course, were to be definitely for and about whites only. We did see just about every other network and online journal as accepting a little more diversity than we would like, because we thought that we white people deserve something all of our own, with just ourselves talking to each other without anybody else getting in on the act. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, and it was definitely an ideological a need for a space for ourselves and to talk about what we think is important without interference.
Yeah, and we're trying to do that, and it can be difficult. I'm not going to start out with that right at the moment, but I am going to bring up a little bit about the comments, because the comments are hard, a little bit hard for me to manage in a way that satisfies everyone and that satisfies me. And I'm going to give some reasons for that. But I'm glad that we have that space, and we want it to be used for real nice conversation among white people and not people venting or just venting, you know. A little venting is okay, but pushing certain things without really caring about what anybody else has to say. So there's that, you know. We want this to be a space. And of course, we've been busy, so maybe we haven't done everything that we could have done, that we can't, will do in the future. But we want it to be a space for whites, and this was our intention. And we want a lot of good program content. And then with the program content comes the ability for listeners and so on to comment afterwards and discuss with themselves about what was on the program. So that's the idea there. and it's not always easy to manage. And everybody that has comments runs into the same problem. So I realize that. How would you like to explain, Tan, how you see how we've done in the last 3 months?
Well, I could first respond to your comment about comments, and say first that I recommend to people who are curious about what we're talking about here to go back and listen to the very first Heretics Hour, where we talked about what we were thinking at that time. Both of us did that today, and both enjoyed listening to it again. And, you know, we got some things right and some things wrong. I remember you said something about comments at the time, that you were looking forward to having comments because on VOR you didn't have them for a long time, and mm-hmm. and so you wanted to have the comments. And I know that you feel a little bit stressed by the comments and the exchanges that have happened so far on the White Network, because sometimes people don't get the idea that the guidelines that you're trying to give them of staying on topic and keeping the comments brief and so on. We have rules for the comments for that reason, to keep the discussion sort of on track and keep it from getting derailed. But in your own defense, I would say my expectation was never that the comments were going to be where the discussion between whites was going to happen. I saw your show, especially having interviews with other people who are openly pro-white, and you yourself being openly pro-white, and me with my sort of monologue shows being pro-white, and the show you're doing with Hadding, with the International Jew, this is what I was thinking of. It wasn't necessarily, let's provide a platform for any Tom, Dick, or Harry white guy to come along and speak his mind. Tom, Dick, and Harry can have plenty of places where they can go and do that. This is really for us to create a space to cultivate the kind of conversation that we're interested in having. And we're not going to agree. As I said during that first show, I didn't expect to agree with everybody, and we're going to have some criticisms for some people, and we'll have arguments about what's best for whites. I think that's a healthy thing to do. I just wanted that to be the premise of our arguments, is what's best for whites. I want that to be at the base. So,
yes, yes. Okay, well, and you know, as it turned out, when we did that first show, we had the clear idea. I was fully in agreement that we would be talking about what's best for whites, and while I would be having guests from Europe, and I have my interest in German and World War II history and so on, and I would continue with that, and I have my interest in Holocaust revisionism, and I would continue some with that. I didn't intend to go in some of the directions that I've gone in. I really didn't. After our very first show, which was the Heretics Hour show, it was you and I, and we titled it "Whites Talking to Whites," and it's been a very popular show, I'm glad to say. Then I got reading. My very next show was the Homosexual Menace, which really surprised me. I mean, I got reading about that, and I put that thing together in the last few days before time for the show, and now I've gotten, I'm going to try to use the right language, so I can't allow people to use my language against me, but I'm kind of caught up in it, you know, and I think I'm done with it, and then I read some more stuff. And so I can't say that I won't be going on with that to some degree. And so I have kind of gotten, although I was doing that before too, looking in at the movement and with a critical eye, and seeing things that I thought needed to be brought out, not necessarily criticized, though you can say that. I mean, it might come out that way, but just, you know, looked at a little more deeply. And this is in my nature, you know. I'm like this. But it's not something that I snuck in here, you know, which doesn't fit. I don't know how people see that. I know it's not your cup of tea exactly, but you haven't been against me doing it. So there's that element of whites talking to whites, which I think is quite valid, of talking about, you know, our own community and what's going on in it and what's best for it. I guess right. I could end with that.
Yeah. Well, my attitude has been that you talk about what you'd like to talk about, what your interest is. I'm a heterosexual man with a family. I don't even like to think about homosexuality. I don't particularly care that they exist. It's not my plan to do away with homosexuality. I don't want to even think about it. But I found your approach to it and your critique of it, especially the fact that you found some people that were, I think the Somira fella, that is almost a homosexual supremacist, if you could say, is disturbing. And I don't want to be led by flamboyantly homosexual leaders. It's a dead end biologically. It's not the values I want my kids to learn either. So, that's all I'll say about that. I don't like, of course, the personal animosities that are created whenever there's any criticism within our movement. And I do have a general feeling that we are a relatively small band of people, and we have a target-rich environment on the outside of people who really hate us all, homosexuals or not, and that, you know, I personally choose to aim it at that target-rich environment outside, but I can see the value also of getting our own value systems straight and getting our own leadership. Who's going to lead is a valid question, and who shouldn't lead.
Yeah, I do think I would like to see more of this, more of that discussion. And most people, I'm not saying are the people who comment on our pages, but most people out there, white nationalists, don't like that kind of discussion and don't want it, period. And to discuss, well, how is our leadership going? What should it be doing? Who's doing what? And what's working? What isn't working? They don't seem to want to talk about that at all. I don't really have any answers for that. I wasn't planning on saying anything about that tonight. So I will say that I think is open and should be part of our discussion. I'll just leave it there. And unless you want to say a little more about something else, this might be a good time to bring up the subject of Voice of Reason, because I didn't check again before the show, but this afternoon, all day today, they seem to be offline, but that doesn't mean anything in particular, because they might be working on it, you know?
Right. You know, I think that it is a good subject to segue into, because if they're related to each other, your original digging into the homosexual issue involved, to a large degree, Voice of Reason. And I know we both heard from, and mostly me, from people who were very unhappy about your criticism. They didn't go to you directly. They came to me and complained about it and were very upset about it. So I know that was a bit of an issue there with VOR. But in our first show, I wanted to remind everyone, and myself included, that I see, and I think it's bad that VOR is off the air right now. And I saw VOR, and I still do, as the technical inspiration of what I did to create the White Network. I have a lot more to say about it, but this proves something that I kind of suspected, I guess, in the back of my mind, that is a bad thing for us in general, our white advocates in general, is the single point of failure weakness of having either a single place where so many people rely on, and when that single point of failure, the person who's running it or the person who's funding it, goes away or it gets shut down by the ADL or whatever, that we are very disrupted by that. And it's that disruption bothers me. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that we created this new network and decided to carry your work over here, and I started up my work here, and that we weren't caught up in VOR going down, and, you know, just two more people that would have been disrupted by it going down.
Well, that's right, and you have said that you would like to see a lot of a lot more sites and even networks, small networks with maybe one or a few people rather than everybody in one big network. You think that's a better idea for our safety? That's kind of what you were saying.
Yeah, coming from a technical point of view, the software, that's the phrase, the single point of failure, comes from software. And the easiest way to solve that problem, the most common way it's solved, is by decentralization, by making lots of smaller pieces that are autonomous and independent, rather than trying to gather together in a single network. Now, there's power behind having a single network as an interest group or a lobbying group. In that respect, you want to have people that are have a common interest. In fact, this touches on our group interests, that we want to have people identified as white and openly willing to do things in our group's interests. But we don't, from a technical point of view, we don't all have to be yoked together on a single website that is vulnerable to attack. For that purpose, we should be separate.
Yeah. Okay. And so we would encourage people to do that and to maybe try to do something on along the lines that we have done here, which takes the right kind of software, but doesn't take a lot of people, a lot of personnel work, which was maybe the problem at Voice of Reason. I mean, I always felt it was the problem that there was one person doing who everything relied on after a certain point, you know, and that wasn't good and it couldn't last, but it just kept going on that way. But there are multiple problems there. I would just like to say that, some people associated with Voice of Reason were kind of pointing the finger at us and particularly at me for problems that Voice of Reason started having. And really, I had nothing to do with any of those problems. And whatever has happened there, as I said, was kind of coming for a long time. But I hope for the best. I hope that they will. They're upset that people closely associated with VOR right now are upset nothing happening there for quite a while, and they don't have any answers. But I think I think somebody is probably working behind the scenes and gonna try to come in and do something there. And I don't think that whole website will be gone. So there's a lot of valuable material that it has in its archive. So,
right. Well, so I think it's mainly the main problem is a hardware failure. That's what triggered the stop in progress there, and eventually it's gone offline. Who knows why? No, it's one of the problems here is nobody really knows why, because Mike Connor, who was the central guy there doing everything, has dropped out of contact. So I think, you know, what you and I are reacting to here, this the accusation pointed at you, and I feel it too, directed at me, is, you know, the indirect comment or allusion to it that Matt Parrott made when he came on and made some comments on a recent post. And it's sort of rumors and people saying negative, nasty things. It's not even – I don't really want to talk about it because it's just negativity. It's
yeah, I think it'll just pass away. As I said, it's just people in their frustrations. But if they would think about it, I mean, it really there are some people want to say that what I have been, the kind of programs I've been doing, has contributed to that. I don't believe that at all.
I think the enemy
didn't have to.
The enemy has far worse critiques. I guess maybe because it's coming from friends that the critiques that you made were considered so devastating. But I don't see it that way. First of all, I see it as being a technical problem and maybe a burnout issue with Mike, but not so much caused by your criticism. If criticism was that easy to bring down all of VOR, well.
Well, of course it wasn't. And this brings up a real good point that I think we have to be clear about. The idea that we should never criticize one another mediocrity and misuse of in different ways that that go on and on. That's bad for the movement. So, of course, it has to be, you don't want to go too far in either way. You don't want to go so far in never saying anything against a fellow white nationalist, if they call themselves a white nationalist, you know, and just supporting everything, and you don't, or to the other extreme, where you're just, which I hope I'm not doing, just critical of everything I see and everything and everyone and outing people for this or that little thing. But I think what I'm doing, I think is, it's important in my mind, so that's why I do it. And I'm not doing it to, just hurt somebody, for no reason, just to build myself up in some way. So, I don't know if we have any, anybody sending any mail about, we'll have any questions or comments about any of this, but so far I don't see anything. So, I will, we'll go on to, well, I had an idea in my head. Now I kind of forgot it. But, well, let's talking about networks. And, talking about criticism. And this fits in with what I think we want to say about ourselves and what we're about in a way. And I should point out that you and I are two different people. You are very clear about that. And when I say we, I'm not trying to say that, you know, what we're just walking along thinking the same thing about everything. We're just very tolerant of each other, and we just, you know, respect one another as having the right attitude and being professional and doing their own work. So, but we do have this, we do agree on the network. And speaking about networks, I will use like RBN or Republic Broadcasting Network as an example, or Oracle, those types. There's a number of them. They're all very similar, and they have advertising. And actually, Voice of Reason was planning to move more toward that, to reach more people, because they do reach more listeners. They do. No question about it. And, but we have a different idea reaching our core, that we can really build a strong cadre, which is the way the work of William Pierce has been described to me, and what I've learned about William Pierce. I knew that kind of, but I've learned more about it recently, so that this is the way to go. And I think this is an important discussion. Goes beyond just, this is what I was talking about with criticizing leadership and so on, but it's not so much criticizing as discussing what is the best way to do it. And of course, there's probably never a one best way, but there is the big tent and the little tent philosophy, we can call it.
Yeah, it's not even about the size of the tent, I don't think. It's more about selectivity. The VOR style, the strategy there was to branch out into a bunch of semi-related areas and hopefully bring to the attention of people who might eventually become interested in pro-white, a pro-white way of seeing things. And I'm not really interested in trying to convince people to become pro-white. I think people will naturally become pro-white as they realize that being a white person is not all it's cracked up to be. I mean, the contradiction that they see in the world, where they're constantly told that they have white privilege while they see that they don't have white privilege in reality, will eventually cause lots of white people to realize the same things that you and I realize. And then they will look for other people who have already opened their eyes to this and are talking about it, and then they will find us. And that's what I mean about the, you know, who gets into the tent. The 14 words and the idea that we're talking about what's best for white people is sort of a prerequisite. You've got, in order to even care about what we're discussing on our site and in order to actively participate in it, to be welcomed by us, you have to already have that in your head and accept that premise. I hope that it becomes a big tent eventually, that 90% of white people start thinking in those terms, what's best for white people. But at least right now, it's a very small percentage. And even if we advertised on primetime television for the white network, it wouldn't do anything but bring a storm of nonsense on our heads.
you know, we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children was real important to us in the beginning, and we do have it on our above our mission statement. Well, that's under about on our website, about us kind of, and we have that a statement there, and we started out with that statement. And in the beginning, you had some pictures of white children as you were, you know, just designing the site and getting it ready. But now, of course, it's all taken up with our shows. But I think we still should have that. I was thinking, looking at the website, and you know, I haven't done any website designing. So I don't really go in and do that kind of that part of it. You're better at that. You're in charge of that. But I think if we had a space there on the front page, under our headline or underneath somewhere, you know, featuring something besides just the latest program. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Let people know
what we're about. And I think white children is really, we have to think in terms of propaganda. And white children just, you know, reach everybody's hearts.
They tug at the heartstrings, that's true.
Sure.
And yeah, with the white children, I was using that imagery as a sort of branding of the site. But the fact is, for our posts, our subject matter isn't so much about child rearing and child interest. It's this very serious stuff about the attacks we're under, and a lot of times the pictures are of our enemies. So
And sometimes they're depressing. You know,
they're depressing. Yes,
they're not. So it'd be nice to have some nice pictures along with it, you know, somewhere else.
Here's an idea just off the top of my head in response to what you suggested there is having, and I had thought of this way back, is having a picture of the week or kids' pictures of our visitors, of the people who like the work that we're doing, that we solicit for them to send in pictures of their children, their loved ones, for us to post in a box on the front page.
Oh, I think that's a great idea, Dan.
Yeah, I don't think we get all that much traffic at the moment, but as it ramps up, then hopefully we would get a steady stream of pictures, and maybe even open it up for our visitors to vote thumbs up or thumbs down on certain pictures, and so that they would be controlling.
Thumbs down on somebody's family.
Well, just, you know, in order to be able to filter and decide what pictures appear.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I'm
well, I think that's great. That's more work for you.
Yeah.
But I think that's a real good idea. Your ideas are always good.
Well, thank you. But
you never throw out bad ideas, I don't think. All right. So, yeah, this is good. And, you know, our society is, I feel like I've noticed in the last week or a few weeks, maybe it's just what's been put on the pages that I look at on the internet, just becoming so black dominated and also homosexual dominated, which is another reason why I can't get away from that topic because, you know, I'm sticking it in our face all the time, you know, in the wider culture. So then I, you know to think it becomes more important to me in our own smaller inner culture. But, you know, this the blacks seem to be taking over more and more. And it's not the blacks doing it. It's the Jews, the media doing it. You know, the media putting them out there in front to where you see at least as many black faces as you do white faces and stories about black people as you do white people. Which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, no, I've said similar things about the Jewish influence in media and the blacks that we see, too, being foisted on us by them. And I've said that in my defense when people accuse me of being obsessed with the Jews. Well, it's in the news every day. Every day in the headlines. You don't have to go to Jewish newspapers to find stories that involve Jewish malfeasance. It's right there in the headlines of the mainstream news. And of course, it usually isn't described as malfeasance. It's usually just poisonous ideas, things that are bad for white people that involve Jews pushing them. And one of the themes that they're pushing is blacks. So, you know, this is a long-term trend on television, you see the black rocket scientist, and in the films, you see blacks as God or as Nordic gods, just put in places where they don't really fit.
I got this from somebody, and I don't have it. I don't have it available here. Sorry, but it was a movie being made about a hero leader in Finland. I can't even come up with his name, but he's a real person. A real Finnish hero. And they've made a movie of about him with a black man playing him. And there are some pictures I saw there and so on. I imagine other people have seen that. I mean, just crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's a sign of what I've been talking about on my series of podcasts is identity. And there is an aspect to it where white people are told that we're bad people if we want to have a pure white culture and a pure white environment in which to live and in which to raise our families. That's racism. That's horrible hate. Mm-hmm. But every other group that wants to identify itself as separate, racially even, like blacks, the Hispanics, Jews, they create their own places where they can discuss things and plan for their best interests. And people, the same liberals who attack whites for doing that, don't give them any trouble. So they have movies about black subjects. I think of Spike Lee and his movie about some black regiment in World War II, and he's free to make those movies and say whatever he wants in them. But then you've got the example you gave, or I'm thinking about some of the other silly movies where they put black characters in really what are white roles. And it's like we're not allowed to have our own culture with our own people accurately represented. But the roots of that go way back. I mean, when the Jews were making movies, Westerns, 50 years ago, they were it was Jews writing the stories, and they were metaphorical stories about Jewish concerns.
Probably about human rights and stuff like that, and how to equality and.
Well, and the poor, oppressed minority.
But you know, when they this movie, when they take a real live, a national hero, and in this case in Finland, a Finnish man. You know, how white and northern can you get? And then they seriously, and they're giving rave reviews to this. With this strange-looking black guy, quite black, a slender fellow, I never heard of him before, but as playing that role as though this is something really great, you know, this is just going too far. This is going too far. And my point with this is that our people need to get a little more serious about this. And, you know, last week on this program, I had that good show with Will Williams and Hadding Scott, and Will was telling us a lot of things about his experiences with William Pierce and his other experiences too. And he told us that story about how William Pierce had said to him during dinner one night, "Damn it, Will, it's not enough to tell the truth. We've got to fight." And in my program, that made a big impression on me. And in my program page, I said, well, it was, you know, the idea that we had to fight. Well, I said we have to fight with the truth, but I didn't emphasize that enough, because the fighting is what's important. And I think it's time, you know, people say, oh, it's too early, or there's no way we can fight. Well, I don't mean just to go out and start, you know, beating up on people, or just go out and thinking you're going to start a fight. But I mean, we do have to think in terms of fight, I think. And I think we need leaders who are going to get us ready for that, or talk about that in some way. And I don't see, and there's two, and when I say we need to get, our people need to get more serious, here I go with my criticism again, but there's a lot of people following very good websites. You know, we know some of our good white nationalist websites, very good articles on them and so on. And then you have lots and lots of comments afterwards, and they're kind of the same people, though, you know, and they talk with each other. Well, that's whites talking to whites, like we're recommending. But they just they kind of go over the same stuff over and over and over again. I don't feel that. I don't know. Maybe people are being educated by that. Maybe it's doing some good, and other people come to it. Of course, that some of that happens, but it doesn't seem to be enough. It seems well, the times that we're living in.
You've given me so much to react to. First of all, I want to say that, that show that you did with Will was a great show with about William Pierce and with Hadding. That line there, that little story that he told, had an impact on me too. Just the retelling of the story has the same impact he said it had on him at the time.
Yeah,
it isn't enough that we just be right. We have to fight. I've come to that conclusion myself too. But to hear that William Pierce said it, it just gives that much more emphasis to it. And I would say we have to fight without apology and without compromise. That's the lesson I would take from our enemies, is that they don't doubt themselves or their purpose. They pursue their interests, and that's what's so important about getting the 14 words and the what's good for whites as the premise straight right from the beginning. Is, you know, we're not going to be fooled by other things to distracting us from that. As long as we have that as the basis, we can still go wrong, and we can still have devastating arguments with each other that are turn out to be bad. But it's a lot less likely if we start off with that as a base.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else did you want to talk about?
I don't know what the rest of it was. I had something else I thought.
Okay.
But go ahead, and I'll maybe I'll think of it.
Right. Well. All right. There's talking about fighting. Is the thing is how to fight? How do we fight? What is the right way to go about it? That's the difficulty.
Now, yeah, I did have another thing there. Another point. When we were talking about creating the network, and I was thinking about doing my own show, I had already started listening to podcasts over the previous year or two, so I already had an idea of how it works and what people talk about. And that, but I went out and got an extra smattering. I threw an extra wide net, and it helped me to decide what I wanted to do. And one of the main things I wanted to do, as much as I like entertainment style, pro-white entertainment, joking about or making fun of our situation or just commenting on it, griping about it, and with a no-holds-barred attitude, I wanted to focus more on educational things, things that would help explain to people what the tricks are, how we're being beat. You know, I was thinking of a metaphor of a coach who has figured out what the other team is doing and where our weakness is, and then starts drawing on a chalkboard. You know, this is what they're doing to us. This is how they're doing it. This is our weak spot. This is how they're hitting us, and we got to plug that hole, and we got to make sure that they don't do this anymore to us. So that's been the guiding principle of my podcasting and what I intend to keep doing. I want to create something that's of value, not just, you know, commenting on current events, which I think is useful too. I like to hear that stuff myself, and I like to do it myself. But I, for the podcasting that I do, I like to make something more lasting, something like what William Pierce did with his podcast.
Well, I've thought about that, about your, because, you know, you keep yours to a half hour still, which a lot of people, including me, would think it'd be good if you went to an hour. But
it's all
but
I've got. Yeah.
Well, sometimes you say, well, I've run out of time when you still got things to say. So I said, hey, you're not out of time. You can give yourself more time. But anyway, that's it's working. It's working well. And as people knew, the time you spend just getting together that half hour, you see, these things to get everything right. And you do like to get everything right. And you know, I listen to your podcast two or three times so I get it all. Because my mind tends to wander after certain things are said, and I'll start thinking about it, and I don't. So that's good. And I was gonna, and that's a good connection there with Pierce, that he did half hours, and they were really full of stuff. And you didn't need any more. You just did one a week. So.
Well, and I want to say I'm no William Pierce, but that's what my model is in my mind is trying to produce quality. like that. Yeah.
Well, you don't know. Eventually, you may have a big archive there, and people will look upon it the same way as they and get as much out of it as they get out of William Pierce's today. I think so. They're very good. So I want to bring up. Everybody has their own way of doing things, and you can't. There's no reason to tell. To think that people should do it differently, like maybe I would think or someone else would think. I have my own way and everybody has their own way. And that's good. And that's something we have to go with. And, that's not a point or a problem, but, what to do, other ways to fight besides our programs. I feel a little bad. I'm going to bring up this idea of the white ADL. Again,
no, that's good. That's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah, yeah, in this last part of this first hour, because I brought that up. I actually titled a show that way, and you were on it, wasn't that the one you were on?
Yes,
and David. Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
That's right. And I thought that seemed like a good idea, but having an idea and then carrying something out is something else again. And a lot of people got excited about that. Well, when I say a lot of people, I heard from quite a few, 5 or 6 or so, who really were like, oh yeah, let's do this. And they were, real enthused. And I said, well, I'm going to talk about this some more. And then I still haven't done it. I want to talk about it with you now.
Sure.
A little bit.
My initial reaction might have sounded negative. Because my basic point was that if we don't already have a white ADL, it's because there aren't enough white people who care about their white identity and white interests to create one. Mm-hmm. That and the fact that it's very strongly discouraged and the white organizations that we've had in the past have been sued out of existence. Let's not forget that we have an enemy and an adversary that's working against us, or many adversaries and enemies, in fact. But in general, I support the idea. I think any white person who has a white racial consciousness would think that it's a good idea. It would be great if we had white lawyers fighting battles for us in the courtroom. And not that I have any illusions that it would actually – that we'd prevail, but we need to fight at least, fight on every battlefield that we can fight on. And, I would love it if some white lawyers would come together and create such an organization. And that's primarily what you'd need. The backbone of such an organization would be people with legal training. You'd also need people with PR background, because a lot of that is PR and some fundraising. But this gets into what I say, that a white identity has to precede white people organizing to create things like that. People have to be committed, and people, even if they don't participate in the organization, working for the organization, then there have to be committed people who will fund it.
That's right.
That would be
you
a
need
big
funders.
Problem.
Yeah. Funders, but people shouldn't fund things unless they know and are convinced that the money is going to good use, because there's too much money, I think, amongst us that is not going to that good use, although, I probably shouldn't say that, because people might think anybody that sends me something is wasting their money. So,
The problem is not enough money. Not that too much money is going to maybe causes that you're critical of.
Well, sometimes there's very wealthy people who have given a lot of money for something, and then they didn't get anything. Nothing came of it.
But the larger problem is we don't have white millionaires that think of themselves as white people and trying to do philanthropy that will benefit white people. That's racism. And if they openly did such things, say they set up a scholarship at a university even for European American or white kids that only white kids can qualify for, they're attacked. And they're attacked not just verbally. It's not just people trying to shame them and calling them racist. They are attacked economically and politically and every which way they can be attacked. That's why they don't do it.
Tan, that image that I picked for our program today, which you finally saw of Sisyphus rolling the big boulder up the mountain, it really fits with this idea of forming something like a white ADL, because it is such a huge, huge, difficult job, you know, to actually put anything in real life. Although our people used to do it back in the 20s and 30s and so on. There used to be people doing out there with real organizations and so on.
Well, Henry Ford is a good example, a very wealthy man who he didn't personally do all of the work, but he used his money to pay a staff of people to produce the International Jew.
Yeah. All right. And so then there were a lot of people, white people, who still thought that we could do something. We could fight off this threat. And this power of the Jews, basically, it really is, and communist, you know, it was the two things were combined, but somehow they have really won out, and there's very few people who feel like they want to go out and really do something like that.
I suspect it's not so much that the people don't care; it's that they think it's futile. They think it would
That's
just be flushing
it. Well, I mean, they didn't think it was futile then, but now most people think it's futile. So that's kind of what I want to talk about. What is the futility here? What is the what problems are we going to run into? I happened to get an email from a fellow today that I never heard from before, and he's German nationality, but he doesn't live in Germany now. But he wrote a bunch of stuff about. Well, he used the circumcision story in Germany, basically that, you know, when in I think it was in northern Bavaria, or was it further north, a judge found circumcision to be illegal in the country because it was done, for one thing, it's done by these Jewish mohels. They're not doctors, they're not certified medical practitioners, but they do this as a religious rite. And some little boy died from it, or I don't know. There was a couple of them in the United States, stories that came out maybe following that about one child died, another one has herpes. And I don't know about this one in Germany. I think he did die, and that's why they said, well, this is, you know, we're going to make this illegal. So now the Jews are, you know, really out there working very hard. And this person said the Jews get together and network, and they have they've got Angela Merkel saying she's going to not allow – you know, she's going to protect the Jews and their religious rights and so on. And it's also practiced by the Muslims and so on. And so she's going to take care of all that. And he says, we don't do this, and we should do it. And he had been listening to my shows, and he liked the idea of the white ADL. And he thought we really needed this kind of thing. And, you know, he's wanting me to... to get this going, I think the concept is a good concept. It's just that we should have some organization. If not, all of us should be doing it though too, to look out for our fellow white people, whether they're white nationalists or not, when they're being attacked or being mistreated, or it usually is a white nationalist of one sort or another, or, you know, being railroaded, or, you know, at least write about it, point it out, and come to their defense. You know, when, can't think of his name right now, I should, but the redheaded man who was I don't know his whole story. See, there's different...
Oh, the Colorado shooter, you mean?
No, long before that, the lawyer from the Northwest who was accused of wanting to kill his wife, and his trial, the whole thing went on so long, and they found him guilty, and he's in prison right now. You know,
Yeah, I'm spacing on his name too.
But anyway, people know. You know, there was a lot of mixed feeling, and there are people that were really supporting him. Then there are other people who said that it's hopeless and he probably was guilty. So who believed he was guilty? I don't know, because I have to be ashamed and say that after a while it didn't interest me enough. I just couldn't pay enough attention to it. So I don't know. Maybe that's because there's
Steele.
Steele, yeah, Edgar Steele.
Yeah, Jane Kelso focused a lot of attention.
Yeah, some people did, and I know people who sent a lot of money. supported month after month, week after week. Really, people who have money and are good at supporting things really sent money there. And you don't know. That's an example of something that could have been supported big time, but I don't know that it would have done any good. People were divided. Now, as far as an organization that would actually have people working there, they wouldn't be able to be paid. They'd have to be volunteer, but there should be an actual group of people who organize this thing and who are willing to devote their time to it. And yeah. Then, of course, you would look for legal help and legal advice. And even if you couldn't take things to court, you could still do your best to make some noise about it. I don't know. I mean, it would be starting small, but it would just get us in the habit of doing something, of saying, well, we need to fight back. It'd be a way of fighting back.
Yeah. I assume that there are white lawyers who are thinking along those lines already. And, maybe they'll be prompted by the call for a white ADL to create one, but we can't really motivate them more than that to say that, yeah, we support you. We'd be behind you in doing that. We'd like to see you do it because neither of us is lawyers, and we're already involved with the white network and doing what we do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. We need
more. Well, that is the problem. The problem is that everybody says this should be done, and they're looking for somebody to do it. And, we all do that because there's some things we know we're just not going to do because it's just not our thing or whatever.
Right. So it's something I wanted to say about Pierce in the comment about the show you did with Will Williams and Pierce. It ties in with an idea that I've focused some energy on, which is this suicide meme that we're – the idea that we're not fighting hard enough, that we're flawed, we've done stupid things for 70 years. We've just gone backwards because we're just so stupid and we've been lacking in leadership. And I don't think that that's true. I think when I examine what's happened and how we've gotten to where we are, what I see is us being defeated by an enemy that is conscious of their own group interests and has very strong, they may be smaller in numbers, but they focus their energy much more effectively than us, and a lot of the energy that they focus is on keeping us divided, on keeping us confused. And I think things are getting so dire for white people that they're not going to be able to just wave their hands and blow smoke up our butts anymore to keep us from doing anything about it, that we are going to realize that something's wrong, and we're going to start to white people are going to start to search out explanations. And that's in part you opened my eyes to this a bit too in your series. I think it was about 2 years ago now that you were talking about disinformation, and how a lot of that disinformation. It's not, I don't want to make it sound like I think there's some grand conspiracy of people being paid to create conspiracy theories and disinformation, but there are people who I think instinctively sense that there's a storm coming and they need to diffuse the animus that is inevitably going to come down on Jews in particular, because of their Jewish identity. They think, oh, I better start making up something else for people to blame, somebody else for people to blame. And that ties in also to the comments you made about putting black people out there in front of us all the time. There are Jews who are promoting blacks in sports and as heroes, as cultural icons, as examples. They want us to race mix ourselves into oblivion. But then even there's a movement or a splinter within our own people trying to attract people who would otherwise be attracted to white nationalist thinking and white nationalist movement that instead want those kind of people to focus on the blacks instead and black violence. Black violence is a real problem. And ironically, the blacks that are being focused on in the media, the fact that the media spins it in a positive way and suppresses the violent stories, is taken by these people, like I call them faux white people, as energy for them, as an explanation for their explanation that blacks run America, and that's why there's no stories printed in the media about black violence, is because blacks run America. It's one of the ways that they're basically trying to diffuse the anger that white people and the blame that white people are going to, and rightfully so, can pin on Jews for creating this situation that we're in here.
Strikes me is that it always comes back to this, and you are so correct that it comes back to a lack of white racial identity in white people, and that's what really needs to be built up.
And let me just emphasize the point that there have been white men and a fewer number of white women, but white people have been talking about this since Henry Ford's day and before. Going all the way back, you can find a line of people. Many people who have stood up and they've been crushed, they've been destroyed. I think it's a little bit depressing to look back at the past and see in a white society that had far greater racial consciousness and white cohesiveness than we have today, that even in an environment like that, that these men were destroyed and their message wasn't paid attention to.
Do you think it's instructive to watch and see what to study what the Jews have done, how they've done it,
sure.
And then?
Yeah, we have to counter it. We have to figure out how to inoculate ourselves against it.
Turn it back on them. I'd like to be more active.
I agree.
Yeah.
Use their own tricks against
them. Because if they manage to do this, they manage to change us around in really a short period of time. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, you know, tonight we've got 30 seconds here, Tan. I'm going to give the words to this song. I've got the right song tonight. And people have been asking about this song. It's Opa, ich vermisse dich. I'm slopping that up. Granddad, I miss you, and I really believe whatever people say. You are a good man. Grandma said you're a hero who gave his life for the country. Her tears were not lying, and I wish I had known you. That's the chorus. I've got a couple of verses. Well, I'll read the verses in English when we get back from the break. So enjoy.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Opa erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht, und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Sie erzählt von einer Zeit, für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann, die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to read the two verses from that song. And you know, they're very simple little, they're about very simple things. There's no deep, profound message here except the love of your family. And this is typical of Germans, truthfully, and Germans of that time. And so after the chorus, it starts with, then there's a the first verse is, it's one of these days when we're at grandma's. It smells of cakes and coffee. We hang on her words. Her tears are not to be overlooked when she tells of granddad. They all walked a hard road in those days, and I look at the pictures on grandma's wall. And then the chorus again. And then there's another verse. She told of a time unthinkable for us, made up of tears, joy, and pain. And always when she said granddad, her voice sounded soft and warm. She shut her eyes and fell sleeping on my arm. They all walked the hard road in those days. And I look at the pictures on grandma's wall. And that is a very song that's been around for quite a while by Sleipnir, a German musical group, and it was very popular. So, I'm here with Tan Stoffel in the second hour of the Heretics Hour, and we are talking about the problems of our white, of developing white consciousness in our white people. So, Tan, I was thinking that, I was thinking about going to speak about this one article that I just can't leave alone. It's from last week or so. I'm just going to very briefly mention that, and because I think this is the way it's going. As I said, we see more blacks all over the place in our, you know, in our news and TV and so on. They've got everything that's being achieved. They point out the black person or some other non-white person, and we have we're also homosexuals and so on. And now, and they're cracking down in different parts of the world on, what they call neo-Nazis. And of course, especially it's always going on in Germany. But the same thing is going to be happening here. So this is why I think it's we're not just talking about Germans, but we're talking about, what's in store for all of us. And here, this story was that they had arrested in a kind of a raid, you know, that had been planning it for some time. 26, what they say in the news, alleged neo-Nazis. Of course, you know, what are they? They're not. They just call them that. 26 of them, they're on trial in Germany for what amount to basically pranks. You know, the accused, they are accused of attacks that included attempting to set fire to cars, throwing stones through windows, and street fights. So they're accused of also of spray painting neo-Nazi graffiti and damaging 40 election campaign signs and putting stickers on street signs over the street signs. They make it say Rudolf Hess Street. So I guess that's how they become neo-Nazis. They range in age from 19 to 54. They've been keeping files on these people for starting in 2009 until they arrested them in March. They keep files on all these people, and then they get a group of them, obviously, and they go out and make this mass arrest. People probably didn't even know each other, a lot of them. It's not like they're a group, you know, functioning. They're just different people. And they're all on trial in this court in Koblenz with penalties ranging up to 15 years in prison. Now, that doesn't mean that any of them are going to get 15 years in prison, but they could, and I don't know what they'll do with them. But it, mostly I think it's just propaganda that they want to put out in the news to scare the Germans from having anything to do with anything, parties or anything that would be close to that, or talking to these people or listening to these people or anything.
Yeah, it's actively disarming the natural defense that people create for themselves or try to create for themselves, and there, it would be a stronger defense if it weren't for the government's constant actions to discourage it and punish it, as if there aren't millions of Turks, violent Turks in Germany already, and other aliens creating even more mayhem that they could crack down on. But if they did, then the media would be screaming about racism and about fascism and Nazism. And this is, you know, the German government is becoming a new National Socialist regime or something, if they were to do something like that. We have a similar problem in the United States, where with this Wade Page incident, we saw an outpouring of fear and loathing directed at white people in general, but specifically at skinheads, who are supposedly a plague, you know, just waiting to kill everyone, as if we don't have mestizo gangs by the hundreds of thousands causing all sorts of mayhem in the United States. Don't pay any attention to them.
They're not a big threat. And that's why, like Kairos will say, and it's so painful for him, about the things that the Muslims do and get away with, and they're not even charged. Rape and all kinds of terrible things. And yet we know that whites, particularly who are pro-white, get picked up for any and every little thing. So this is part of the reason why the whole idea of an white anti-defamation league is important, and why people responded to it so much, because we all know that what we're in for. I don't know. Some people think that, you know, there's a certain point when things snap or something, and we just have to wait for that to happen. There's some truth in that, but I guess we continuing to try to educate people is important. And how about this story? I do want to talk about, maybe I'll throw this in here before we go on to some of these stories. And if there's anything else about the network you want to talk about too, we'll do that now. We talked in our first show about having other hosts, and we thought we had some people lined up who wanted to do a program, but something, they never did come up with anything. And it's not easy, you know, when people start thinking about the reality of it, and that they have to keep it up, you know, one right. show up, another one.
Well, I had my own hesitation, my own misgivings early on in that first show we did together. I was kind of tentative about, I don't know if I'm, when I'm going to do my show. I wasn't convinced that I could do it.
Yeah, but I knew that once you did it, you would like it, and now you say you really enjoy
it. I do enjoy it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like kids, you know, I thought I wouldn't like having kids, but I really do enjoy having kids. I can't imagine my life without them now. I could imagine my life without a radio show, but it is fun. to do it. And I get a charge out of providing that information to other white people.
Yeah, we talked about how it's easier to say things on, you know, talking than it is to write it all out, because we're kind of perfectionists, both of us, and a lot of people are. If you want to write something good, you really have to work at it and edit it a lot. It's a lot of work to write. And I'm sorry I'm not writing like I used to, but I am enjoying doing the radio and being able to just get on air and say things. They might not come out so well or so perfectly, but I think we also reach more people this way. I do. I don't know, but I do think so. Anyway, there is somebody now, just recently came forth and is working on, it sounds pretty serious, and I think we might have another show from this person in the near future, but I don't want to say anything more about it because we don't know, you know, he's not even, but I think he's pretty serious. I think he'll be pretty good, and I think we'll all enjoy it. So I just want to remind people that that we are open to people having radio shows. Of course, you have to conform. Everything has to conform to our mission statement, which is on the webpage under About. So you just look at that, and it has to conform to that. Otherwise, as long as it's a good show, we're pretty open to it. So that's an invitation. Now, you had, if you want to say anything more about the network, Tan?
I think I've said everything I wanted to say about that. Maybe I'll say some more in response to some of these other articles we might talk about.
Yeah, and it can always come up later on. We can always go back to that later on. So are you had brought to my attention today this one in the griot.com, White Flight from Social Media. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. I think it's directly relevant to what we're doing because we're trying to create a sort of white social media. The article is about a competitor to Facebook, or a sort of splinter off of Facebook, that it's a geek who wants to create a social network of geeks, by geeks, for geeks. And he wants to charge, this is the important thing about it, he wants to charge $50 a year to belong to it. And with the premise being that by charging that, it will discourage most people from joining. And the blacks, of course, picked up on this as being a secretly racist thing. It might be, who knows, but that it certainly wasn't explicit. And it shows to me, this article, their blatant hypocrisy. Here they are on the Griot, which is a website dedicated to addressing blacks about black interests, and they are expressing this sort of really poisonous jealousy that white people might create a space, and I have to emphasize might, because it's not even a space explicitly dedicated to whites. They just might want to get away from blacks. And they make the analogy, or they draw the connection to white flight in reality, in how white people vote with their feet. When too many blacks move into a certain neighborhood, the white people, because there's no recourse in the law to keep the blacks out, the only thing whites can do is pick up and move somewhere else if they don't want to be around blacks. And, you know, this is related to the Jewish question, and how this whole victim mentality that the blacks have copied from the Jews, that they've gotten this idea in their head that they can just push this button called racism and guilt trip us into not excluding them. So they have to go wherever we go. They have to be in our movies. They have to be in our fairy tales. They have to be princesses in movies, because to do anything else would be to exclude them, and that would be racist, and it would be bad for them. They try to convince us it would be bad for us too, but meanwhile they're creating isolated black spaces for blacks, because they realize it's human nature to want to have a space just of people of your own kind, where you can be comfortable and socialize with these other people who have common interests with you. Well, whites need that too, and these blacks don't want us to have that. And they're not alone, of course. They're following the example that Jews have set.
Well, that's the, you know, this idea. This is what all white people understand. This, at least the white people that talk to me, they all understand this. That this idea that that we whites cannot, we're forced to accept all these non-whites into everything that we might be doing. We can't keep them out. Is ridiculous. And this on itself should be, we should attack this openly. Not attack, but I mean, we should speak out against this openly. We should oppose this. We should, you know, speak reasonably about it, how unreasonable this is. And this is not hate. I mean, they call it hate. This is a Jewish trick, you know, that they have brought out, you know, oh, we'll call this hate. And now everybody believes it's hate.
Yeah.
White people. Like, well, my sister-in-law, she, you know, she would believe, and she's the only one I can really get gauge, but she would believe that that's hateful. And if you try to question her about it, you know, she tries to make some argument for it, but it doesn't make any much sense.
What's hateful to have, for white people to have white spaces where we can
I mean, and then she would finally agree, well, you're right, well, that's right. But, you know, she doesn't, she just falls for that because she sees it all the time. I mean, people are just, are convinced. A lot of white people, without really thinking it through, that that it's hateful if we want to keep out non-whites from anything.
Yeah, yeah. And well,
it's not.
Well, I guess it's it is a dislike. It's an alienation that we have from others who are too alien from us, who creep us out or in whatever other way turn us off, and we want to exclude them. And it's. My point would be not that it's not hate, but or that we have to be polite about telling people about it, that we don't want to be around them, but that we just do it. And when they force themselves on us anyway, that we realize that this is demonstrating that they that we were right to not want to share our spaces with them. If you know, it's back to this saying that someone put in my head a long time ago about immigration. You know, let me in your country, you horrible racist. If we're so horrible, why do people want to be around us? That's the part that doesn't make any sense.
Well, they want, it does make sense because they're going to get benefits from it.
Well,
because,
what I say is what their excuse
that
we're bad
true.
People
yeah.
is a right. lie. They
yeah, but
realize
that's not
the
truth.
The space we create has value and they want to be in it. They want the value, but they know that the secret is to push this button called racism, and that will open the door. And that's what we have to stop. We have to cut the wires to that damn button so that white people don't feel that guilt and that we will organize in our own defense to, if we want, to have the white network. And screw you, we're going to have it. We're going to talk about what's best for white people. And no, you're not welcome here if you're black. We don't want to hear your complaints about us talking about what we want to talk about. So that's what I would say. And the fact is that this article isn't even attacking the white network. It's attacking a social network that is not even explicitly white. They just suspect that it might be white. Let me read one paragraph from the thing because I think it's indicative of the overall thing. Can this be stopped? Daniels believes. Daniels is this Jesse Daniels, a professional black who's a professor at the City University of New York. And an expert on cyber racism. This is going to be a real dilemma, basically figuring out how to engineer around white people's bias for all white or mostly white spaces. You know, they're well aware we don't want them, that we will pick up and move away if we have to in a passive way, or that we'll create elaborate tricks like charging $50 a year to try and shield ourselves from them. And yet they still want to come after us because, as I say, they see the value in living in white neighborhoods because they know it's safe and clean, even for black people. They don't like the consequences of being around other black people. Even black people don't want to live around and be surrounded by black people. But that's not our problem, and it shouldn't be our problem.
These people want to come here to live off us, to get something from us,
to
get welfare benefits and so on.
Yeah,
so this is what ought to be said out in the open and plain as day. But, of course, people are going to resist it. White people are going to resist it. And they're going to come up with things that say, oh, that's not true because this or that or the other thing. But you have to have your arguments ready.
Well, and they say it's hate. Let's address the argument that it's hate. in a certain respect, it is hate. In the same way I would hate it if somebody comes and kicks my front door in and sits on my sofa, turns on my TV, and starts taking food out of my refrigerator, and then tries to call me a racist hater. And I'm supposed to back away from them and not do anything about it. That's what they're doing here. They're imposing themselves on us and then trying to call us names and make us feel guilty that we're somehow doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is a way of fighting to talk plainly like this. And of course, a lot of people do, but yeah, I think we have to be careful not to let this kind of talk go down further into, you know, what does sound hateful. You know, you don't want to sound hateful. You want to sound reasonable. You don't want to start calling people names and doing a lot of stuff that, you know, just let it the argument deteriorate. So, but what you are saying is absolutely makes sense to every person. And I think when you do make that analogy from coming into your country to coming into your house, it's very powerful.
Or in this case, coming into our social networks. I mean, it's bad enough that in the real world, in the workplace, you can't refuse service to people that you don't want to give service to because of the color of their skin or their race. We don't have that freedom of association in the real world anymore. The courts have taken that away. And so here, even online, we try to create spaces where it's just white people in indirect ways. And they still want to worm their way in. They don't want to be excluded from being around white people.
No, that's right. And I think this is a big issue. More should be made of it. We have the right for freedom of association, and it shouldn't be labeled as something evil or hateful or whatever. It should just be a right that everybody should have it. They have it. You know, slavery, who was it that was that fellow I had on, lawyer. He made that real good point that slavery, what it took away from the blacks is freedom of association, because it makes you be where you, you know, be and be among people, you know, force these blacks to be among, I guess, whites, you know, as slaves or whatever. You know, but that he thought that was a good legal argument. Anyway, you know, we nobody should be forced to be around people they don't want to be around if it can be helped. I mean, you know, if something. Now, you know, Tan, I checked my email and I had quite a few of them, but most of them don't really fit into the program too well. And I don't know about this one, but I'm going to bring it up because I asked people to write in and, you know, and they want to participate. I want them to participate. So, but it brings up VOR again. And, you know, I don't want to hammer away there, but it's an interesting question that we can look at for a little bit here. Sure. Because he says VOR, and I don't know how well this person, I've hear from this person fairly regularly, and I don't know how well he knows about Voice of Reason. He may be, you know, been on the periphery there or something, or he may know some people, because he wrote a previous one about Mike Connor, but I'm not going to read it because one thing, I don't think he's correct. So, and he said this one, he says Voice of Reason was trying to reach the thinking 5 or 10% of white people with content that will awaken them racially. The content that was tangential was to draw people that would not knowingly go to a white nationalist site. And then he says this is a direct continuation of the mission of Dr. Pierce. Well, I don't think that I really don't think that Voice of Reason was really succeeding at what he says they were doing. I'm not sure that really describes what.
Oh, I think it does. That corresponds with what I think was the plan. And in my conversations with Mike Connor, the impression that he gave me was his overall intent. That's true. But I think it's trying to sneak up on white people and sneak racially conscious messages in their ear and hope that that's going to wake them up is not the way I would go. I'm not going to say that I don't think it's an idea that should be tried. I have nothing against VOR or anybody else trying to do it. But for myself, I'd rather dedicate my energies just to talking to white people who have already decided, hey, I'm a white person, there's nothing I can do about it, and I want to know what I can do. Where are there other white people who care about the things I care about and want to do something about it? And that they'll find us. That's
what I find at fault with what this person is saying is that he says they want to reach the thinking white people with content that will awaken them racially. And then he admits that there was other content that was to draw people who were not would not go to a white national site, and some of this tangential content would not so much awaken people racially because it was anti-racist or it was verging on it. So that's where I had my complaint that they said that's what they were doing, but it wasn't exactly they weren't exactly doing that. And then is this a direct continuation of the mission of Dr. Pierce?
The White Network?
Well, no, VOR, wanting to reach 5 or 10% of thinking white people. I think that's true. But he didn't have tangential content to draw people that wouldn't go to a white, that weren't interested in white nationalism, did he? I mean...
They made no apologies for having pro-white guests. I was a guest. They had your show on, and Jamie Kelso was always very explicitly pro-white. But I want more. I've wanted an explicitly out in front. We are for white people. You and I, that was one of the points that convinced us that we should have a separate network and not just be hosts on of radio shows on VOR is to make that point that it's pro-white. We are explicitly pro-white, and we want to exclude Jews, too. That was another sticking point, that the VOR didn't see any problem with having Jews on as guests or hosts probably never, but there was no firm commitment, no open commitment to that.
Okay. Yeah. I got more, but they just don't quite fit anything. And there's a couple of them that don't have anything there. Somebody sent something, but there's nothing in it, so I can't do anything with that. All right. Well, we are another story that really interested me was the one in the New York Times, Health, How Well You Sleep May Hinge on Race.
Yeah.
That's too funny. I can bring that up here.
Well, let me tell you the two things that I thought were important about that one. It's yet another guilt tripping of white people. It's noticing that there's a racial gap. And they say right near the beginning of the article that non-Hispanic whites get more and better quality sleep than people of other races. Studies repeatedly show blacks are the most likely to get shorter, more restless sleep. What researchers don't know yet is why. So right there, they admit that there's a gap, but they don't know what the gap is, what causes it. And later on in the article, they let some black person, in this case, whose only credentials are that he's a Brooklyn resident, say that he thinks discrimination plays a role in his sleep problems. He says, as a black person in America, even if you succeed in terms of education, you still have to deal with the inherent inequality of society. So this is that victim mentality that it seems like everybody but white people is supposed to think of themselves as victims. And what I think is important for a white person is they're telling themselves that white people are the people who are oppressing them. White people are the beneficiaries. We have privilege. We sleep better than they do. And this creates animosity. It creates a bad feeling in white people, which hurts us. But it also creates these grievances, these ideas in black people's heads and non-white people's heads that they are somehow being wronged by white people. And this has real-world consequences. This causes them to discriminate against white people and think that they're right in doing it. Because after all, they've been told over and over how whites discriminate against them. So this is just fair is fair as far as they're concerned.
This guy who's he's an activist for black causes or something. And, he says, Oh, there's A. It's not his. Well, somebody had a...
He's an administrator.
Somebody who sleeps poorly, grew up in Miami in a bad neighborhood, and he heard people shooting guns all night, dealing drugs. That's this guy, Molindo Stewart. It's him. He lives in Brooklyn now, and he weighs 260 pounds. He used to weigh 310. And he blames that on the neighborhood he grew up in. Well, it's probably a black neighborhood. It's his own. It's black people, but somehow that's the fault of white people. And this just points out the way they make us responsible for everything, and that is wrong with them. And it's not going to change. I mean, in fact, they're ramping this up, you know. And maybe if it gets so bad, if people would actually read this. They would, a lot of white people would say, well, what's going on with this? You know, heck with this. You know, I don't like this guy doing this. So, you know, maybe if it gets so bad, a lot of white people will react to it and say, this is stupid and I quit.
Yeah.
I quit taking the blame.
Exactly. That's what white people should do when they read this stuff. I mean, if you read it closely, you can see that race consciousness is in the news every day. These two stories that we're talking about have just occurred in the last week, have been published in mainstream source. Well, not the Griot so much, but, you know, you can find these kind of stories all the time in the mainstream. And white people, their eyes just glaze over. I think they are tired of hearing of it about it, and they don't pay close attention like I am and you are, picking apart that this is a guilt trip and a you know, laying the blame on white people, and that if you're white, you can't escape it by just being saying, oh, I'm an anti-racist, or I'm colorblind, I'm race blind. They're not satisfied with you just being race blind. They want you actively working for their best interests. You know, actively helping them to get into white communities and get a leg up.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, that I thought that's kind of an odd story, but it's very revealing. When you see the picture of this guy, and you just can see him. Well, you know, it's all white folks' fault. And
The article starts by saying they don't know why. They haven't figured out why. They haven't put their finger on it scientifically. But that doesn't stop them from spending the whole last two-thirds of the article speculating about how the various ways that whites have more privilege, more wealth, and so they sleep better than all of these poor minorities, these poor non-whites, who suspect it has something to do with racism and discrimination. And they print this. It's irresponsible. You know, if it was printed about Jews and how Jews get the best sleep of all, Jews would be screaming. There's where the ADL would come in and threaten to sue them out of existence or call them horrible Jew haters. And, you know, we're going to tell your advertisers about this, and they're going to pull their advertising because they're mostly Jews anyway. That's how the ADL does what they do and how Jews do and accomplish, you know, getting any criticism of them silenced. But we get the blame for everybody else's problems.
Yeah. Well, then going along with this, sort of, is just the way that, again, the media is reporting things and taking something that is nothing, like in these last couple of stories we talked about, and building it up into something. I really love this story, which is from August 22nd. Called Europe's Summer of Fascism, Five Countries to Watch. So I'm going back to Europe again, but it's instructive. You know, they say xenophobia, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and anti-Roma sentiment have plagued many places in Europe this summer. So, you know, if you're going to be traveling, well, watch out for these places, I guess. And, of course, it's written by Alex Perlman, a Jewish person, and they mention Austria. And what's wrong in Austria? Well, Heinz Christian Strache, the leader of Austria's far-right Freedom Party, posted a cartoon on his Facebook page, which they have decided is anti-Semitic, and they're building all that up into a big, big problem for him. And it's a pretty funny cartoon. It's supposed to be against the banking establishment, but this rich banker who's pigging out at a restaurant, all this food in front of him, does look definitely like a Jew, and they say he's got cufflinks with Star David. I can't tell. There's star cufflinks. There's not. They're not cufflinks. They're buttons on his sleeve of his jacket, on the sleeve, you know, by the wrist. And they look like stars, but I can't really even make out that they're stars of David. But then he's being served. The waiter is called the government. He's called the banker or the banking establishment. And then there's this poor, thin, tattered fellow sitting there at the table with nothing in front of him but a little tiny dish with a dry bone, you know, eaten up dead bone on it. And he's the folk, you know, the German folk. And so they make a big deal out of the fact that, that he published, that he put this on his webpage. And then he took it down after everybody, you know, after there was some reaction to it. And he hasn't apologized for it.
Yeah.
Now, then they go on to France.
What's to apologize for? It's a very pithy, to the point, political cartoon. It's very effective because I think it demonstrates, it may be a characterization, an exaggeration in some ways. It's a cartoon after all. But the Jews had a problem with it because it was hinting that of the Jewish role in the banking and in the beneficiaries of the banking, where they're being bailed out. And they wouldn't have had a problem if it was a stereotypical German banker, the caricature, or if it was a stereotypical Frenchman or British and Englishman. They only have a problem that it seems like it's a Jew. The reality is that Jews have a huge influence in international finance and are huge beneficiaries of the profits that banks have raked in. You know, Goldman Sachs, it's not 100% Jewish organization, but it is a very, very strongly Jewish organization. Many Jews working there and benefiting Jews very largely.
Yeah, and it also is very true, and they've brought out, and it's true, it's reminiscent of the kind of cartoons or what you call I'll just call them cartoons that were prevalent in Nazi Germany, like in Der Stürmer and things like that. So that's true. It is think it's funny. And why can't we have some fun? They do all kinds of things and get away with it. You know, I just see this and I just applaud, and I'm so proud of Strache our white right-wing politicians for standing up and doing a few things. You know, it's very tough for them to do what they're doing in Europe, but I think they're very brave, and they need a lot of support.
I agree. I wish it hadn't been pulled down. I want to make the point about psychoanalysis and this phobia business that you started off quoting from the article about Islamophobia and xenophobia.
Yeah.
This is a clear marker that it's Jews and a Jewish narrative. They are pathologizing European peoples for having a grievance against these bankers, and who are not all Jews, but there is a Jewish nature to it, and that cartoon identified the Jewish nature to it. And white Europeans have every right to object to getting screwed by this banking system that is impoverishing them. It's ripping them off.
Exactly. Just and, like this little figure, this man, you look at him, it's pathetic. And you think, look at that poor guy. Why does he stand for it? And then you realize that's us.
And
it's happening to us.
One of the ways, and it's not just this example, but in general, our objections to immigration or other things, they characterize as phobias, as if we have some sort of a mental problem to want to defend what's ours in order to protect ourselves. It would be very easy, and we should. It's not going to be effective against the Jews, but we could very easily say they're the ones who are crazy attacking us for wanting to defend ourselves. It's not true. You know, I see it in a more objective way that they're basically just advocating for their best interests, but we have every right to advocate for our own best interests too. The white advocate part of me that's thinking no apologies and no compromise says, you know, I don't even want to see it from an objective point of view. I want to see it from a purely pro-European point of view, that we should be able to draw whatever pictures we want, characterizing things in whatever way we want. And they are the steps they take against us have very clear markers to them. The psychoanalysis is one of them, the phobia business, and characterizing everything we do as hate when we're doing it in our defense is another one of those characteristic markers too.
Yes.
Jewish fingerprints on
very good. Very good. And then, so now the next country is France. And so what do they have against France? What's the terrible thing happening there? Oh, they're two things. First, anti-Muslim sentiment. Who wrote this thing? Oh yeah, a guy named Perelman. Anti-Muslim sentiment. Because of the ban on burqas and other facial head coverings. Well, good for the French. The French are don't have a very good record of standing up to these people. They're all over their country, but they want to get rid of having to go out on the street, on their streets, and see all these hordes of women covered with burqas and other head coverings and facial coverings and so on, roaming around and, with their baby carriages and so on. Good for them. Well, that's Islamophobia. But now the other thing is they are so hard on the Roma. These Roma are these gypsies who come and invade and live in these filthy camps. They make them filthy, but they say, oh, look at the conditions these people are living in. Well, they made it that way. They're their camps. And they say the Roma face a similar and brutal kind of discrimination in France, and Human Rights Watch and other organizations are concerned. And so this is, going to bother people who are coming to France to see how badly the Roma are being treated. And they say that they're, I don't know why I'm even using that word Roma. There's the word is gypsy, and then there's some other words that actually fit what they are. They came up with that. They want to be called Roma. That's not a good name for them. Anyway, they're from Romania, so I don't know how any other way that connects with them. But, they're rounding these people, not all of them, but some of them, and they pay them 300 euros and give them a plane ticket to go back where they came from, which is mostly Romania. And then in Romania, we're going to have a little story about Romania further down. I might as well go there right now and finish this off. Where did it go? Well, it's pretty. There's a whole bunch here about Greece. Romania, they're complaining about Romania, too, because they send these people back home, back there, and they have to go into these where they live, these ghettos where they live, and they're just terrible places, even worse than the ones in France or in Western Europe. Well, that's because they make them that way. You know, if you've seen the areas where gypsies live, the worst kind of places you can imagine. They could fix them up. They could do something. They don't. That's how they live. They make money. Some of them get rich, but they don't make themselves live any better. At least, most of them don't. And HIV and AIDS is increasing, they say, as well as crime and illiteracy. Well, we're supposed to be responsible for that. We're supposed to take them in all over Europe and give them a lot of help, and that's going to somehow change them. It's not going to change them. They haven't changed in all these, hundreds of years. Many hundreds of years they've been around. So this is the big problem, they think. What were you going to say?
Well, about the Roma, they come from outside of Europe originally, and you're right. They've been in Europe for hundreds of years, kicking around from one place to the other. They're sort of a poor, less intelligent version of Jews, essentially. But I trace a lot of these problems, a lot of these complaints, a lot of the basic mechanism that these quote unquote minorities use to guilt trip us comes from Jews who figured out the trick a long time ago on how to get Europeans, how to make Europeans pliable and open up their borders to Jews first. Before there was much of a gypsy problem in Europe, there was a Jewish problem, and Jews got to convince the leaders of Europe to declare them equal citizens. That was Jewish emancipation, it's called now, 200 odd years ago, and fits and starts across Europe. And since then, it's just been emancipating one victim group after another, to the detriment of the white societies,
you're not kidding.
Societies.
Oh, they're just causing terrible mess there. Now, they go to Greece, and what's the problem in Greece? The Golden Dawn Party. Oh, right. they won some seats in Parliament. Oh, such a terrible thing. They're known for their swastika-like symbol, and they salute one another, reminiscent of Nazis. So they're serious nationalists. And
right.
Again, they have Human Rights Watch, making comments. And And now they say that there's a wave of vigilante violence against immigrants. There really isn't. But there's some people, you know, that are saying things. Now, here's a little story they give that here's how they play this up. After after the right wing party, after Golden Dawn won its electoral victory, a week later, they say 50 of its members, but later on, they Golden Dawn denied that any of these people were members of their party. But that's how they write it. That so we'll just say 50 people who looked like this were riding came riding motorbikes and were armed with heavy wooden poles and went through this town, this gritty suburb of Athens, and the. They careened around the main square on their motorcycles, some brandishing shields, and they delivered an ultimatum to immigrants and said, "You're the cause of Greece's problems. You have 7 days to close. They have some shops. Immigrants have some shops there. Or we'll burn your shop and we'll burn you." Well, this is one immigrant said that that's what they said. You know, who knows what they said. But, you know, what's good is that in Greece they are organizing. A lot of people are organizing, just the same somewhat in Hungary and well, to a much lesser extent in Romania, to say, you know, we don't want you. We don't want you. People want you to leave. And this needs to be done. But, of course, it's portrayed as something just terrible,
right?
Just horrible.
Well, that's where the cognitive dissonance comes in that finally wakes up white people is they are told they have to be tolerant and can't oppress the poor minorities, and they come from such a war-torn place, and they're looking for a better life for themselves, and all this other sob story stuff. And as long as things are okay, as long as there's enough wealth flowing, as there was in Greece before the financial trouble, mm-hmm. As long as you're borrowing money and everything looks shiny and new and is working, everything's fine. But when it collapses, well, now things get real. And the only way, ultimately, that you're going to force a home invader out of your home is with the threat of violence or violence. And it's either you that's going to be doing the violence or some agent of yours. And in this case, you know, what people, when they talk about this stuff, and talk alone is not going to do it. If you talk to somebody who's trying to invade your home and say, hey, you know, you really shouldn't do this. This is wrong. If they see enough value in breaking into your house and that you're not going to do anything to defend yourself, they're going to come in and they're going to take what they want and they're going to do what they want to you. You have to be ready to defend yourself. Talk is necessary to plan and to organize a collective response. And hopefully you have a government that's willing to defend your borders and your people to keep this from happening. But this is what's happened ever since World War II. There was a, you know, this cataclysmic war fought with armies. Ever since then, it's been unarmed armies invading our countries. These non-white people using flying in on planes, coming in on boats, swimming across and walking across rivers, coming in without any weapons at all and playing the pity card, the I'm a poor minority, I'm a poor oppressed minority, and you can't keep me out because that would be you'd be treating me like the Nazis treated the Jews. And that's why the whole Nazi thing is important to confront and deal with, the Holocaust issue. We have to face that because that is the core, that's the keystone of the logic that has disarmed us for 70 odd years and kept us from organizing and doing something in our own defense.
Yes, and so in Hungary they are trying to stand up in their own defense. I'm really so proud of the Hungarians. But they're of course listed here as being a problem. And in July they say that there was the small village which was populated by Roma gypsies mostly and famous for the 2010 sludge flood. That after a 2,000 person Jobbik rally took place in the square there, or Jobbik rally, that's that far right wing party that's doing such a great job in Hungary.
Nationalist. It's better not to use their language of pathologization. It's a nationalist party.
It's okay. You're right. A nationalist party. I don't know. I'm always using right wing because I don't even like that term, but I'm always using it. I should think about that and change my.
We're normal people. We're normal, healthy people with normal, healthy instincts that like
That's
our
right.
own people and don't want to be invaded and told what to do by aliens.
Right. And so So after this 2,000-person rally, then some of the people, supposedly, they call it a mob, descended into this village, descended on this village of populated by Romans. And some of the members of this crowd, so we don't know, we're talking about maybe a few people here, chanted anti-Roma slogans and threw pieces of concrete and other missiles at Roma houses. So a few people, they can't say all of them, some members of the crowd picked up some pieces of concrete. I guess they have concrete laying all over the place there, and threw them at the houses. And they were telling the people they didn't that they didn't like them or whatever. Anti-Roma. Well, everybody's against the Roma gypsies. Everybody. And they always have been. There's just nobody. At one time when they kind of weren't so many and they had to behave themselves, they'd come around and play their music and so on. Well, then, you know, they could be tolerated. But now it's a different story because of the European Union. They're able to go wherever they want because they're European citizens. Because they're from Romania.
Right.
And it makes them a European citizen. They can go anywhere.
That gives them freedom of movement. But then there's also the socialist governments that have created these welfare systems where, you know, the money gets dispensed. It gets collected from the populace as a whole, and then it gets dispensed to these poor, oppressed people who are, you know, need the help. That wasn't there in past generations, and that exacerbates the problem as well.
Yeah, and then the only other thing they have to say about Hungary, and this is the end of it, is that there is this politician named Szigeti, who supposedly he said something, and what was the deal here? I may be mixing him up with somebody else.
He's not the one. Partly Jewish.
Yeah, he's partly Jewish. He's not the one who had to go to the Holocaust Museum. That was a different politician. He just found out he's partly Jewish, but then this writer says, don't get excited. He's not totally reformed from right-wing anti-Semite. According to the AP, this Szigeti is quoted as saying he just defines himself as having ancestry of Jewish origin because I declare myself 100% Hungarian. Yep. And the writer says, because you can't be both, apparently. And this is something we've talked about.
No, you can't.
That's right.
You can't. No, I like the contradiction there. The assumption that, you know, somebody who discovers that they're partly Jewish should just immediately, the impact of that should be that they should sympathize with the Jews entirely, 100%. That's the power of biology. That it's Jewishness is a biological thing is one thing that comes out of that article. And even the Jews sign on to that idea that it's a biological thing. This guy had no upbringing as a Jew. It was just, I think, one of his grandparents was Jewish. And the assumption is that this should have a tremendous impact on his mind, his Jewishness, his biological Jewishness. And yet here, even white people who are 100% white aren't supposed to be worried about white interests at all. But Jews, that's okay. Even if you're only one quarter Jewish, you should be just so concerned about the Jews that you shouldn't even criticize them for the horrible things that they're doing. As the Hungarian nationalists and the Greek nationalists and Romanian nationalists, all European nationalists do, even if it's only in private or in indirect ways, because the Jews are involved in doing nasty things in Europe for mm-hmm. their own interests, in their own best interests, and against the interests of the European peoples.
Well, I wasn't sure if this fellow kind of started being more pro-Jewish after he found out he was partly Jewish, but it doesn't say that anything about
no,
that here.
What happened is he was forced to resign because he had tried
oh,
to
pay right,
off.
Oh, that's right.
He was being blackmailed. Some fellow who found out about his Jewish heritage came and tried to blackmail
right.
him. I don't know if it was blackmail, if he was trying to blackmail, but the politician then tried to pay him to be silent. That came out, and then the party forced him out because of trying to bribe somebody. It wasn't, or at least that was their rationale for letting him go or whatever, was that he was dishonest enough to bribe about it. The official statement, as I understand, was that they didn't care about his Jewish heritage. They cared about the bribery, the attempted bribery.
Yeah, that's what they said. And, of course, they're getting all excited about it out there and all this stuff goes on
well,
and on.
Just to be clear about it, because of my own personal situation, I have kids who have one Jewish grandparent. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with a white organization that wants to exclude people like that, or even exclude people like me for having that kind of connection, because I think that exactly I agree with the assumption of people who write articles like that, that Jewish identity is that important that even one quarter biological Jewish in you is enough to, it has been, as we've seen in examples like this one and others in the past, enough to motivate that person to serve Jewish interests rather than the other three quarters of their biology and their people. So, you know, if white people, if I was with a group of people that said, hey, you know, we distrust Jews so much, you can't be part of our organization, I would have to shrug my shoulders and I'd say, okay, I understand you. I wouldn't try to guilt trip them and say, hey, that's racist. That's anti-Semitic. I would just go and say, okay, well, I'll do what I can do for white people over here somewhere else.
So, yeah, I know you would. Well, here's something kind of related in the last couple of minutes here. That we could bring out maybe, and this is what I was listening to the Political Cesspool radio program from August 11th. I was looking for something to listen to, and I went there, and I found something that looked up, you know, might be interesting. And it was James Edwards talking to Brother Nathaniel Kapner.
Yeah.
And he made this comment, and I quoted it exact. I wrote it down exact quote, a great guest. After he was signing him off, he said of him, a great guest, you should support his work. There's a question there. This Kapner Foundation, I think he takes in a lot of money because people really like him. I don't know what he does with it all. But, you know, I'm suspicious of that because he is Jewish. So he says, Edward says, you should support his work. If all Jews thought like Nathaniel Kapner, it wouldn't be a problem. And the only problem is with their ideology. I mean, you know, if they thought like us and worked in the best interest of Western mankind, we wouldn't have a problem. He's one of the good guys. Well, in a sense, you know, at first I thought, oh, there's that. But in a sense, if they did think like us, well, we wouldn't. But they don't think like us.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll say first that I like James Edwards. I know he does radio. He's one of the shows that I listen to on a fairly regular basis. But part of the reason that my show is a half an hour is because James Edwards is 3 hours, and I didn't like that. But his point about Kapner, if white people didn't think mostly like James Edwards thinks, we wouldn't have a problem because it is irreconcilable. For hundreds of years, we've tried to integrate Jews, and it hasn't worked. European peoples are different. Jewish people are distinct. They worry about their own interests. They're not worried about Europeans. They're hostile to Europeans, in fact.
Yes. So it's not it's an ideology. It's something that's built in. It's not going to change. And we can't expect that there's going to be Jews that think like us.
As a rule, really. It won't change, no.
Yeah. Well, Dan Staffel, this has been really fun. It's been a good program. We've got less than 30 seconds left. So I want to thank you for coming on.
It was great. It's very easy to talk to you, Carolyn.
Well, I'm glad about that. Well, we have a lot of things that we can talk about, and I hope everybody enjoyed this show. Thank you. We had a nice, good, large bunch of listeners. So we will be back next week with the Heretics Hour on the White Network. See you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.